This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about OCD. So to start off with, I've got a definition from the NHS. Obsessive compulsive disorder is a common mental health condition in which a person has obsessive thoughts and compulsive behaviours. So to start off with, I just wanted to say I'm really pleased to have that definition and for it to be so much more accurate than so many of the stereotypes of OCD that we see in the media. We do talk about that a little bit in the episode. And so I just really wanted to start off with that focus on it being obsessive thoughts and compulsive behaviours rather than specific actions that many people reduce the condition down to, for example, just being clean.
Yeah, just being a tiny and organised person means that you have a mental illness, which, don't even get me started on this. Like, it drives me fucking insane. Sorry for swears, but it drives me so mad when you're like, look at this, like, oh, it's setting off my OCD if something is like slightly out of line. Or like, and also I don't want to like deny anyone's experience. Like, everyone's experience is valid, but when it's clear that they don't mean it and it's sort of used in a really flippant way, that can really just, like, you know when you pet a cat backwards and they just look really pissed off? Like, that's how I feel about that. I'm like,
I've just got this vision of you as an angry cat now.
Yeah, just like, stop touching me. It's that feeling of just like, really, queen, really.
You're so right. And so we get into that in the episode a bit as well, which I was really pleased to cover. So I've also got some stats. So first off, our guest is from the US, so we've got a few US specific stats from beyondocd.org. Contamination OCD is the most common subset of OCD in the world. 25% of OCD sufferers in the US have contamination OCD. So whilst there's many types of OCD, that one is most common to the kind of OCD stereotypes we described there. For some more stats, I've got some from OCD UK, who found there are approximately 750,000 people living in the UK with OCD at any one time. It affects 12 in every 1,000 people, so 1.2% of the population.
Did you say 750,000 people?
I did.
Guess what's back? Yeah. Population corner or
population pocket.
Population pocket. So the city of Leeds in West Yorkshire has 761,481 people living in it. So That's almost the population of Leeds. Bristol is the next one down with 617. So that's more than the population of Bristol. Yeah, Leeds is a beast. It's London's the biggest, then Birmingham, then Glasgow, then Leeds.
And they all have OCD.
Yeah, everyone in Leeds has OCD. That's definitely what I said. equivalent amount just over the population.
For all the bad portrayals you see in the media, they can be really quite few and far between as well, given how common the condition is.
Yeah, sure. I remember one of my really good friends actually was working on a show called Obsessive Compulsive Cleaners. And a lot of the time, actually, I noticed that the people who were the obsessive compulsive cleaners, did not have an OCD diagnosis. And that was very much painted by the way that the film was shot or the footage was shot, in that they don't have a diagnosis, so they must just be making it up. But really, that then made me think, well, why haven't these people got a diagnosis? Because it's absolutely ruining their lives. Like, some of the women were spending £100-200 a week on like bleach alone, like just so they could bleach every single thing in their house. So if that's not affecting your life in a significant way on a day-to-day basis, then I don't know what is.
Yeah, that's incredible. And the mad thing about that is that's the most part of the most common form of OCD. So with our guest, we discussed in the episode, one of the things that held her back from not getting support sooner was just not realizing she fitted into OCD.
Sure.
So for people that are already within the most common subset and the one most frequently kind of stereotyped to not get the support is really sad. It's hard to hear.
Yeah, no, that's so sad.
Another thing I wanted to raise with more stats from OCD UK is how severe so many of the cases can be. That not only is it a very common condition, but also the severity is higher than many other conditions.
Sure.
So they found that 50% of all cases will fall into the severe category.
Wow.
And less than a quarter are classified as mild cases.
Shit a brick.
So for those people experiencing it, it is most commonly severe. And that's, I don't really know what to say about that.
No, that's unbelievably sad.
It's very difficult.
What an awful thing, like, to know that the condition that you're responsible for taking charge of, perhaps as a charity or whatever, like, that you've already got your work cut out just before you even step foot, you know. It's, oh, sorry, I'm not doing so great at words, because I'm just really, really, like, that's so awful.
If you needed any more reasons why this condition needs to be taken seriously, it's because of the seriousness of the condition in those that deal with it.
I don't know why OCD got picked on as the silly one, you know, like the one that's like, haha, you just like things clean. Like, no, that's such a misunderstanding. That's such a stigma that's really, like, doing a massive disservice to a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, and I wonder if maybe that's part of it. It is the severity of it. People want to make a joke and make lighthearted of it, because it is difficult to wrap your head around. It's such an intense condition.
Yeah. But
it's also a condition that is most intense within the sufferer's mind.
Yeah.
Well,
I would want to direct them to a wonderful resource like our podcast, for example, that's working really hard at breaking down stigma, or perhaps a wonderful charity like Time to Change, who are working really hard to defeat mental health discrimination and stigma by opening up dialogues and getting people to talk more. What wonderful work they do. I was about to say they and we do, but I was like, blow my own trumpet. Do, 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 do.
One more stat I wanted to pick up on as well, just to show how young the condition can start, is OCD UK found 25% of cases started by age 14.
Oh, wow. My goodness.
And so that's 25% of cases started by that age. So many will have started way younger.
Yeah.
Am I right in remembering that your OCD?
Very young, yeah. My first memory of having a sort of a compulsive thought or an obsessive thought would have been maybe year 5 or year 6 in the UK. That's 5th grade, 6th grade, I think, is that the same age as it is in the US. I think I would have been about 9 or 10, maybe. Mm. Yeah, like not even double digits, hardly.
Well, on that sobering note, I just wanted to share something positive, which we didn't actually get around to talking about in the episode. So she mentioned that exposure responsive prevention, ERP therapy, was the most useful of all the types of support she's received. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about what that is. So if you do relate to anything in the episode or know anyone with OCD, this could be a really good recommendation. So here's how it's described on OCD UK. It's a therapy that encourages you to face your fears and let obsessive thoughts occur without putting them right or neutralizing them with compulsions. Exposure therapy starts with confronting items and situations that cause anxiety, but anxiety that you feel able to tolerate. After the first few times, you will find your feelings of anxiety do not climb as high and do not last as long. You will then move on to more difficult exposure exercises.
Yikes.
So essentially, it's a technique based on gradual exposure, something that many of us learn about in psychology class, where it's a lot easier to come to terms with certain things and get used to certain scenarios when you're exposed to them slowly. And so you'll be in situations that are gradually more and more intense, and you work on how you control your reactions and the intrusive thoughts relating to those. So I thought that was useful to share.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've never even heard of that before, but it sounds like really, really hefty work.
It makes a lot of sense why it works, really, and I can see how that has applications within anxiety and it has applications within phobias as well. So we'll get into the episode shortly with our guest, Natalie Amo. She is a blogger who has dealt with OCD for a long time in her life, as well as depression. So in the interview, she is incredibly open and honest about her experience. We do talk with some depth about suicide, so that's just something to be aware of going into this. For me, it was a really moving and insightful view into what is so commonly a misunderstood condition. In a moment, we'll get into the interview, but first...
Who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name's Natalie Amo. I've had a lifetime of experience with mental illness, and it started out with kind of phases of depression, and they'd come and go in waves. It wasn't anything unbearable, but I would notice it coming on with this repetitive thought in my head of I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to go home. And it didn't make any sense to me because I was this kid who had a great home and I'd be in it while I was having this repetitive thought. And I didn't know where it was coming from, but it was always my first signal that I needed to change something. And I lived in a house with my twin sister and my mom. And my mom was a psychologist. So it was a very open household when it came to mental illness. And I would just tell her, you know, I think I'm depressed again. And so that was my first experience, I think, with mental illness, was just these waves of depression.
And how early did the depression start?
The earliest I think I remember it was when I was probably around the ages of 10 or 11. And I never knew why it was there. You know, there never seemed to be an underlying reason. I was a very happy kid. I was always a very anxious kid and very concerned about other people. And I took on their emotions and always wanted to make sure everyone was okay. And so I don't know if it had to do with that or, you know, I still don't know to this day why or how that those depressions came on. Maybe it was seasonal.
Yeah. It does sound like you were in a nice, supportive environment, though, with particularly the work your mom was in.
Yes. Yeah, I was very lucky. And I think that luck holds true throughout my life, just that great foundation when it comes to talking about mental illness. It wasn't a taboo subject, like I've noticed it is for a lot of people I've met. And that's a big barrier when it comes to getting diagnosed and getting help. And so I've really lucked out with that background in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's different to a lot of the guests we speak to on the podcast here who have to oftentimes overcome the stigma before they can even start working on the illness. So it's lovely to hear your experience there.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so important to talk about it, because I know that that's a huge issue for so many people. And so I'm just trying to be a small part of that, trying to change the stigma around mental health and that it's just another illness. You know.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And so that's your experience of depression growing up. When did OCD symptoms start to come into your life?
Well, my mom passed away when my sister and I were 16. And we got moved to a new state and a new house and a new school. And I think my sister would say that she noticed OCD symptoms back then. But I didn't notice them until I was in college, so a few years after my mom passed away. And those years after my mom passed away are kind of this weird time period for me where I felt kind of numb, but outwardly I was very the opposite. You know, I was very present, but it felt very fake looking back at it. And I think that was my coping mechanism for everything that had changed and everything I had lost. But I think something when I lost my mom just kind of switched in my brain. And being a person who's always been very concerned about other people and taken on the responsibility for everyone's well-being, I think there was something in my brain that kind of said, you know, you lost something huge and it's now your responsibility to make sure that that doesn't happen again for you or anyone else. And so I think that's kind of what set me up. And there's a lot we don't know about why people have OCD, but I personally think I always had the potential for it. And this was kind of the beginning of that switch for me and just being so afraid of loss. And when I was in the middle of college, I think the stress of college and everything else I was dealing with I didn't have the strength to keep up that mask that I had on for all those years. And my brain actively started to make sure that I wasn't going to lose something again. And I was very happy in college. I loved it there. And I think that's why my brain freaked out, because, you know, now 2 years after I'd lost my mom, I was finally happy again. And so my brain said, oh, you're happy again. You're going to lose it, because you were happy before you lost your mom. And so I think that's when I kind of snapped a little bit and started to overactively try to make sure I was going to stay happy, which was detrimental. And so I just
want to pause on that, because that's such an interesting point, that your brain had equated the two, happiness and loss, had somehow become linked for you.
Yeah.
Very much so. Is that something you realized at the time, or is that something you can see looking back?
That's something I see looking back, and I think I didn't see it until my diagnosis of OCD and looking back. And now that I know it, I can see it in my everyday life. You know, I see something good happening and I can feel myself immediately start to pull back a little bit, thinking it's not, you know, I'm not going to actually reach that point of happiness.
And it makes a lot of sense with what you went through with your mum, because growing up as a kid, that's like an unbreakable rule almost, that your parents, you're going to outlive them. They're going to be there whenever you need them, and that's all you know growing up.
Right.
And so for one of them to go, to not be there anymore, it is going to shake your whole sense of safety.
Yeah, I think, and I have a piece that I've written about her voice always being my guide, and then the sudden loss of that voice. My brain told me I will never have that guide. I will never have that someone who can tell me I'm safe again. Therefore, I will never be safe again. It took the loss of her as a loss of me, kind of. I forgot that I have a voice too that is valid and can tell me that I am safe. And I think my OCD latched onto that, and it uses that as a bargaining tool, kind of, you know, you don't know that you're going to be safe. You don't have the right to make these decisions, because it could hurt you or it could hurt someone else, and you could lose something again.
Right. And so, of course, what you're describing there is an intrusive thought. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand about OCD, is that it's not as simple as just you having a focus on something being clean, or, you know, all these outside circumstances. It's very much a reflection of what's going on inside your mind.
Yeah.
And the extremes your brain is going to. So it's actually far less about the external factors than people realize. Would you agree?
I definitely agree. I think that with my interaction with people in like group therapy and different functions that I've been to where I've met other people who have OCD, a lot of the symptoms are just very internal. And I personally have a lot of symptoms that do have, you know, physical manifestations, like you can see them, but I feel like I'm one of the few, and I don't know if that's accurate, but from the people that I've met, it's very internal, just like mental compulsions are the main thing that I've seen. And it's just like repeating a word or repeating a phrase, or sometimes numbers get involved. And so it's not at all what we see in the media. And I think that that's one of the most frustrating things I've run into in the outside world, is just battling this. It's a very strong misrepresentation. Like, it's in everything. I see it almost every day when I watch TV or listen to the radio, or even just like on social media. Everyone, it's this phrase of, that's so OCD. And it's because we see it as, like, even up until I was diagnosed, I saw it this way too, was being organized and being clean. And that's not how my OCD was manifesting. So it makes a big barrier to be diagnosed when all we have is this misrepresentation of OCD.
Right. I think that's a really good point. And it's true that that does hold a lot of people back from getting the support they need, because whilst contamination OCD is the most common, it's not the only type. And so actually there are plenty of people with versions of the condition that don't involve cleaning at all. Mm-hmm. And so potentially there's that whole group of people there that aren't getting treatment as soon because they don't realize they don't fit the OCD stereotypes that are so productive. And instead, when I talk to people about OCD, I try and encourage them to think about it more in terms of the intrusive thoughts. Because mm-hmm. I think for many people, they are relatable. We've all had it where a crazy thought comes up in our head of like, oh, imagine if I just threw this ice cream at that person's face. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it can be the most wild things, or it can be potentially something we'd recognize more as relating to mental illness, like, oh, imagine if I jumped on this train track. And mm-hmm. for most people, that's something that they think, oh, what a weird thought, and it just goes mm-hmm. again. But if you can relate to having those thoughts come up, then that's a good place to start when thinking about OCD. Because it's the difference is where you can't control. And it sounds mm-hmm. like with yourself, there was that real switch, because when your mum died, the condition really became rationalized by that experience. So your mum dying, something you as a child should never have to expect happen or go through, then becomes real. And so if you that's real, then all these other bad things could then be possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a really good way to put it, is that the OCD brain rationalizes those intrusive thoughts that everyone else wouldn't even spend the time to justify or validate. You know, it's something that everyone else brushes off, my brain will latch onto and say, what if? And those what ifs become reality very easily with a brain that gets stuck on a loop. That's how I feel like my brain is all the time. It's just stuck on a loop of what ifs. And so those intrusive thoughts, which are everyday occurrences for pretty much everyone, they just become reality in my brain.
Yeah. And it sounds like the way you describe it there, the thoughts really come to control your like internal narrative, mm-hmm. voice inside your head.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I often feel like there's two voices in my head. Like they both sound like me. They're both my thought processes, but it's very frustrating because my brain's always battling with itself, because I hear the irrational OCD side that says something bad is going to happen. But I can also hear the old me that can rationalize through that and use logic to say, like, these are the exact reasons why that bad thing is not actually going to happen. But it's like that rational thought just runs into the OCD side and bounces off. You know, the OCD just locks it out. And so it's so frustrating, confusing, and before my diagnosis, absolutely frightening to all of a sudden have those thoughts not matter anymore. Those rational, logical thoughts that have always been the basis of my understanding of this world to no longer matter or no longer make sense.
For sure, because up to that point, that was how you coped with and interpreted life's ups and downs, and it worked.
Right.
And then you find yourself in university actually really enjoying your life, but yet you feel at your worst. It's a strange contradiction to be in.
Yeah, definitely.
And so at what point did you then seek support and that led to that diagnosis?
It wasn't until after I'd graduated from undergraduate college and I was in veterinary school. And at that point, the obsessions had changed from checking type behaviors to contamination OCD.
Right.
And
Can we just pause there for a moment then? So could you talk us through, just in case the listeners aren't aware of those different types, what checking OCD is like?
So for me, it was checking the stove before I went to bed, or checking to make sure the door was locked before I left the house or before I went to bed. And at first I didn't give it much thought because it started out innocent enough. You know, it just was, I would check the stove once and it'd be fine and I'd go to bed. And then as time went on, I started to notice these rituals kind of develop where I'd have to go to the stove and I'd touch each knob and say off, 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 off on each one. And I'd have to go through that three times and then I could go to bed. But then as time went on, it kept getting worse and worse and I'd have to keep getting out of bed because my brain could convince me that I hadn't checked, even if I had just checked 2 minutes ago. Like that's how I, that's how much OCD can warp my reality of, I can literally physically do something 1 minute and the next minute it says, you didn't do that. You need to do it right now. And it would get so bad that I would get out of bed again and I'd be just crying out of frustration. And I could feel my muscles tensing because I didn't want to be performing these actions that didn't make any sense. But at the same time, I felt like I had no control over them. But at that time, I still didn't think it was OCD. I just attributed it to the stress of school and to grief and depression and all that. So that's the first symptom that I noticed.
And it's interesting how so often these symptoms have a kind of vague logic to them. Mm-hmm. So it's easy, I think, to rationalize up to a point because checking the stove is off seems like quite a logical thing to do. Mm-hmm. But then you'd got to the point where it was really taking over your whole mind. And so you couldn't think of anything else until you checked.
Yeah.
And that's where there's that key differentiation between what's just checking something as a normal person would do, you know, that neurotypical way, and it becoming an obsession and a compulsion. And the way there you describe saying off, the threes, was that a recurring number for you?
It has been. And I was thinking about that the other day. Three was always my favorite number as a kid. So I don't know if that was a sense of comfort or if that, I don't know how that happened. But yeah, three has been a recurring number for me. Like even in college, checking my alarm, I would check my alarm too before I went to bed, make sure it was on because I didn't want to be late for class. And I'd say, you know, 8 o'clock a.m. on, 8 o'clock a.m. on, 8 o'clock a.m. on, make sure it was on. And sometimes I'd have to redo that over and over and over again as well.
Yeah. And it's, from what I understand of OCD, it gives you a sort of false sense of security, right? So you do the compulsions and it eases that anxiety. But it's a toxic coping mechanism because it needs to build on itself.
Right. That's where the loop comes in of, like, for someone who doesn't have OCD, if there's something they're anxious about, they can look at that, find the solution, do it, and then they move on. It's a very linear process. And then for someone with OCD, it gets stuck on a loop. So if I was anxious about the stove and I checked it, because that's the solution, you know, you're worried the stove's on, you check the stove, everyone else would check it and move on. But I checked it, and instead of moving on to, okay, everything's fine, it looped back into the danger signal. So it said, you had to get up and check that. That must mean that it's super dangerous. You know, it's a big risk that that stove might be on. And so it feeds back into a loop of better go check it again. So I check it again. And then it magnifies that danger signal again. And it just builds up on itself over and over again.
I think that's a really great way of describing it, the way you internalize these dangers. Mm-hmm. So the stove being safe isn't because it's off. It's because you've checked and that's what you have to check every time.
Right, yeah.
And so when you did go in and get support, were you aware even at that point that it was OCD?
The first time, so when I was an undergraduate, I went to counseling because I knew that something wasn't right. And I described what was happening. And the way I remember her responding to this was with the phrase OCD tendencies. And so that word tendencies kind of made me immediately just brush it off and not take it seriously. So to me, that meant, you know, OCD tendencies, that's not something serious. I still didn't know what actual OCD was. So I just didn't, it kind of just left my mind after that. So when I went to veterinary school and it started to get really bad, that conversation with that counselor back in undergraduate didn't even pop up in my mind because I don't know if OCD tendencies is even a thing. You know, it was OCD. You can't be kind of OCD, which is what she made it sound like to me at the time.
People use that phrase all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So it wasn't OCD tendencies, it was OCD, but I didn't realize that at the time.
Maybe she was doing it as a way to separate from diagnosis because she wasn't in a position to diagnose you.
Yeah.
And so therefore wasn't going to label it a condition.
Exactly. And I wish I had known. Yeah. And I wish I had known the right questions to ask after she said that. And maybe I could have figured out a way to get me to someone who could diagnose me at the time.
Right, but I think the important distinction there is the right way for her to handle it would have been to make some kind of referral or to encourage you towards some kind of solution. Mm-hmm. So for me, coming to terms with having an eating disorder, that was something mm-hmm. I'd stayed selectively ignorant to. I'd unconsciously mm-hmm. hid that reality from myself, and it was through counselling, my counsellor bringing that to my attention, that then I took the steps of, okay, now I need mm-hmm. to get a diagnosis. Because yeah. I had that encouragement. So it's good to hear that she saw the mm-hmm. context of those symptoms, but it's unfortunate it wasn't the follow through of mm-hmm. encouraging you towards the support you needed.
Exactly, yeah.
And so then when you did get your diagnosis, what kind of support was offered at that?
Well, I kind of self-diagnosed myself before I went to see the psychiatrist at veterinary school. I was at a point where my obsessions and my compulsions had taken over my life so much that I was barely living. The bare minimum I could handle was going to school and passing my classes, but that didn't leave anything for me. You know, I had lost 20 pounds. I couldn't feed myself. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't do the basic human things that were needed to, you know, call life life. And I had reached an all-time low. And so I finally just, and this is where I think I lucked out with that background with my mom's career. Is I knew what questions to ask, and I went online and I started asking these questions, and I found the International OCD Foundation website, and I sent it to my sister, and that this was when I first found the list of all the ways that OCD can manifest, because I had contamination OCD, but my house had never been dirtier or less organized. Like, my house was a mess. And so I didn't think I had OCD. Right. But then I found this list of all the ways it can manifest, and I sent it to my sister, and I just said, I think I have OCD. And she responded, I think you do too. And so I went to go see a counselor. And this is where it got very frustrating, how unequipped the school system was to deal with this type of mental illness, or really any mental illness, I think. I got sent to the school counselor because I couldn't see the psychiatrist without being referred by the counselor. And the second I described what was happening to the counselor, she said, you need to go to the psychiatrist. And so she diagnosed me with major depressive disorder, persistent depressive disorder, and obsessive compulsive disorder. So before I saw her, I was pretty sure that it was OCD. And I think that that's where my background really came in, of just knowing what questions to ask. But before that, before I looked it up, I thought I was losing my mind. I thought I was going to get locked up if I talked to anyone about it. I thought I was disappearing. I thought my mind was betraying me. Nothing made sense. And I just feel so lucky that because I had a childhood where mental illness wasn't a taboo, I didn't have to spend more time feeling that way, because I don't know if I would have survived that.
And so you mentioned that you're not sure if you would have survived it. So how bad did things get for you?
Really bad. I didn't want to exist anymore. I didn't have any plans to end my life, but I was wishing I could just pass into non-existence. I didn't feel like, with my mind not functioning the way it was supposed to and not doing what I was trying to tell it to do, I thought that all my purpose, everything I'd worked for, everything I was working towards was being taken away from me, and that I wasn't going to be Natalie anymore. And I didn't want to live as less than me, or feeling like I was just a part of who I used to be. I felt like my brain was just slowly slipping away.
Yeah. And that's so hard to hear, because it's similar to conversations I've had in the past about suicide, mm-hmm. and that in itself is so frequently misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to work as a listening volunteer with Samaritans, which is a suicide prevention helpline here in the UK. Mm-hmm. People can call them about any kind of struggles. It's not just suicide, mm-hmm. but that is a significant portion of the calls. And one of the questions we were encouraged to ask in these situations was, are you wanting to end your life because that seems an attractive prospect to you, or is it that you're trying to escape your current situation? Mm-hmm. And I think that's in itself highlights a big misconception about suicide, that mm-hmm. it's not that people are running towards that as a solution, right. It's that they're running away from the life they're not coping with?
Yes. Yeah, that's a very important question. I really like how that's phrased. I think that's something that I really struggled with for a long time to come to terms with, because it took me a long time to admit that I was feeling suicidal, because I felt guilty. I felt like, you know, how could I possibly want to give up everything I've been given in this life and all the people that I have? And that's not what it is at all. I finally realized that it doesn't have anything to do with the people I love and the life they've given me. It's just the fact that the current situation that I was in was awful, and I couldn't imagine doing it another day. You know, just the sheer exhaustion of imagining a life like that every day. And being able to separate that from all of these misconceptions about suicide has been a big turning point for me, where I finally realized it's not because I want to die. I don't want to end my life. I just don't want to do this anymore. And I think those are very different.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's essentially the difference that so many people don't realize.
Yeah.
But it's great to hear that you were able to see that it's not a rejection of your life and the privileges you've had, because I think particularly in the US, college is such a privilege. It's so expensive. Yeah. And you'd come from a supportive family, and it can be easy to equate feeling suicidal with letting people down. And of course, that's not what it is. It's a sign that you need support and you need love and you need care. Not that you need any judgment from yourself or anyone else.
Yeah. And I've tried to internalize that exactly, and that I should be proud that even though I've been feeling suicidal, I'm still here, instead of feeling ashamed that I felt suicidal. You know, turn it around and be like, yeah, I feel that, but I fought another day. I'm still here, and I can be proud about that, and not internalize the shame that everyone, you know, associates with feeling suicidal, and instead be proud that I'm still here.
Yeah. That's a really wonderful way of putting it. It's similar to how people describe being a suicide survivor. That you've survived those feelings or even attempts that people have made. It's a far more empowering way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And it puts the control back into that person.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so another thing I wanted to mention with this is how OCD, I feel, is a particularly fascinating condition amongst other mental illnesses, because that battle is so internal. And so I'm sure to a lot of people around you, you were able to cover up what was going on, because so much of the intrusive thoughts and the battles in your mind are happening internally.
Yeah, it was. So when my symptoms were getting bad in vet school, I think that's one of the things that's so exhausting about OCD, is that you can pretend that you're fine, and pretending you're fine is exhausting. And it meant, like, so like when I was going to school or when I've had a job since my diagnosis, I put all my energy into functioning while outside the house, functioning while at school, functioning while at work, and pretending I was normal. And that left nothing for me at the end of the day when I went back home. You know, all of that energy was used up during the day. And by the time I got home, I had no function left for me. And so home life, when I've been in school or had a job, became awful. And, you know, they say don't study in your bed, because then your bed is associated with stress instead of rest. And I was thinking about it the other day, where I associated functioning with work, and I'd get home and my OCD would then torture me because I ignored it all day. And so I'd get home and it would torture me. And so my brain was associating home with torture, and I would dread going home, and I couldn't sleep. I couldn't function. I couldn't eat. And so home, instead of being a safe place, was now my own personal torture chamber. So
yeah,
pretending you're normal is exhausting.
Absolutely. And even what you've described there is so common for people with OCD, that being on your own can be the worst situation, because then you've got nothing to distract from your own mind.
Yeah.
It's very similar as well to what was described by Lily Bailey when I interviewed her on OCD last year on the podcast. And another thing she highlighted as well, that her OCD would tell her that voice quite a lot, was that she needed to hide it from other people. Was that something you experienced as well?
Yes, and I think that the reasoning behind that thought changed after my diagnosis. Before my diagnosis, it was because I was afraid I'd get locked up and labeled crazy. And after, it was just, I was trying my hardest not to identify with my OCD. And I think I was in some form of denial. And I thought if I could hide it from my friends and hide it from other people, then I could pretend to not have it for a few hours of the day. And it just became this crutch that was really detrimental to my mental health, because that thought of don't let other people see these things happen or hear these thoughts meant to me that these thoughts and actions were something to be ashamed of, and that this mental illness was something to be ashamed of. And I really internalized what OCD was telling me. And once I was finally able to break away from that and start opening up about it, I was a lot kinder to myself and a lot less angry with myself. But yes, I definitely had my OCD telling me to hide this from people. And I think it was different reasons than for Lily, if I remember correctly. But I think that's something that's very common through all types of OCD, of just hide everything.
And it sounds like it may have been one of the ways mental health stigma did affect your life, even though you'd come from a quite accepting and open family. Mm-hmm. There can be that in the air because other people don't feel comfortable talking about conditions like OCD. Mm-hmm. We're exposed to positive conversations about it less. And so it's easier for you to believe the inner monologue that says you've got to hide this. This isn't right. You're going to be locked up.
Yeah. Even coming from the background I came from, OCD, we'd never talked about OCD. You know, it wasn't something common to me. It was just a quirk, you know, a silly trait. And I was afraid that if I told people, they would say, well, what's the big deal? And I would feel so defeated because this illness was defeating me and no one else would be able to see why it was so hard. And I was afraid that that reaction from people would invalidate my own fight and that I was weak for letting this defeat me. And so, and I think the first time I've told a colleague that I had OCD, they just kind of looked at me and were just like, weren't sure what to say, because they didn't know it was a serious thing. They're just kind of like, okay. And it was so frustrating because I just wanted to like tell them everything, but obviously it wasn't the time. But it felt so validating the first time I told someone who ended up becoming a very good friend to me that I had OCD, and her reaction was just one of acceptance. Like, she accepted the fact that she didn't understand what that meant, but honored what I was saying and respected what I was saying as this is something that's serious and valid to her and it's important. And she didn't undermine it because of her not understanding it. You know, she just accepted that she's not going to understand it.
And that's so important, that she didn't need to understand in order to still care and accept what you were going through.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's so hard for people to do, because we're afraid of what we don't understand. And I think it's been a struggle with my family too, of just, they can't get inside my mind, so they can't understand what's happening. And I'm not the Natalie I used to be. I remember the first time I handed one of my family members a book about OCD, about this guy's experience with OCD. And they read the little intro part about what his life was like and how little life had because of OCD. And their response was, well, this isn't Natalie. This isn't what her life looks like. And I said, yes, it is. I'm just really good at hiding it. But yes, that's what my life looks like. And so it's really hard for people who've known me my whole life and seen me as a productive, driven, independent person to now become this person who's very codependent and can't hold down a job and is just scared all the time. It's very hard for them to understand that transition. And I think that's one of the reasons why this friend that I made was able to accept it so much easier, because she's just always known me as Natalie with OCD. But my family's known me as Natalie without OCD and Natalie with OCD. And that was a transition that even I'm struggling to accept and understand.
Right. And that's an important point in and of itself, that there's nothing to be gained by not accepting it. There's no one that wants you not to have OCD more than yourself. And so there's no help in anybody else rejecting it. They don't have to understand straight away, but it is important to try.
Mm-hmm.
And so with you getting the diagnosis yourself, how has that changed over time, how you view the condition?
I mean, it's changed a lot, because I went from a place at the time of my diagnosis of knowing nothing about OCD to learning more and more about it and respecting this illness. It's odd to say I respect something that's torturing me, but you know, it's a very strong illness, and it's a very powerful illness. And I think the more I respect that, the more I can respect myself for fighting it every day. And I think it's changed a lot the way I see the world. And just, I mean, I've had to change the way I see myself, and I've had to change the way I ask questions and the way I think. And I've had to question every thought I've had since that diagnosis of, is this me? Or is this OCD? Am I checking this because that's a normal thing to do? Or am I checking this because OCD is sneaking in? You know, I think that the more I learn about this illness, the more I want to learn about this illness. I think I'll never stop learning about this illness. I've really enjoyed talking to other people about it, because everyone I've met who struggles with this illness has a very different story than me. And I think that's a really powerful thing, that we can all share this experience and learn from each other. And I feel like in some ways, while OCD has separated me from the world as someone who I can't leave the house very easily. I can't hold down a job. I feel very isolated, but at the same time, I feel connected with more people than I've ever felt connected to as I've reached out on social media and talked about this illness. And I'm grateful for that.
And that's a really key turning point for a lot of people, when your illness starts to become a skill, where mm-hmm. you can turn it into a specialist area of knowledge as yeah. opposed to a hindrance. And that's yeah. a part of why I run a show like this, because mm-hmm. without ever choosing to, I've needed to learn a lot more about mental illness and a lot more about myself in order mm-hmm. to keep going and to thrive. And why wouldn't we want to share that with others? Because yeah. there are so many people with such similar experiences.
Yeah.
And that's really universal as part of the human condition. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are so many people that will listen to this and relate to it, even if they don't have OCD.
Mm-hmm.
Because the feelings of wanting to hide the condition, the stigma that can crop up at any stage in your life, the challenges getting support, these can relate to any condition, including
exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that OCD really builds off of just our human nature, and we feel so much responsibility. We want to do the right thing, and OCD uses that as a weakness almost, and uses it as a bargaining chip, and says, if you want to do the right thing, then you need to listen to me. And if you want to not listen to me, I'll allow you not to listen to me, but you are risking all of these different things. That's your choice. And I think that's something that people can relate to, whether they have OCD or not, is just this intense feeling of responsibility and this desire to do the right thing.
Absolutely. And that's really the case with so many repetitive, maladaptive behaviors with mm-hmm. or without this condition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been really inspiring to speak to you today and to hear all that you've overcome so far and all that you continue to thrive with. And you're not just speaking to me, you're speaking to so many people through your blog. So mm-hmm. could you talk us through a little bit of that to round up?
Yeah, it's called Obsessive Compulsive Diary because it started out as pretty much just my diary that I decided to share with people, partly out of frustration, because I wasn't able to communicate accurately with my family what I was experiencing. And I thought this, if I could write it down, it would help. And partly just because I wasn't hearing very many voices out there that were accurately representing OCD. I was just hearing all those misrepresentations and knowing how that can be a huge barrier for people to get help. I just wanted to be a small voice. I didn't know if I was going to be heard or not. But it was kind of like a therapy for me. So that's what the blog really started out as. And it has art pieces I've done in it, and it's changed quite a bit, but it's just a journal that I share with people, and it's been very therapeutic for me to get it out because it's so hard to communicate what your mind is doing when you have OCD.
I'm sure. And there's such value of when you are at your best putting these things out there as something to point people to when you're at your very worst. And that's something we can all benefit from. You don't need a blog necessarily. You can easily write down your thoughts in a physical diary to show a loved one when they're struggling to understand, because you're at your worst and you can't articulate it at that point.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's so valuable, and it's so lovely that you're providing that resource.
Thank you.
So we'll wrap up there. We have unfortunately come to the end of our time. Thank you so much for being so open and sharing your experience.
Yeah.
If people want to find you, where should they go online?
It's just obsessivecompulsivediary.blog, and they can contact me through there and take a look at what's on there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing your experience today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.